Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Hey everybody, welcome to the FASD Success Show. This is episode number 31. Here we go. I am glad you're here. Whether this is your first episode or your 31st episode, thank you so much. This is the podcast. This is the place where you come to learn from others about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder so you could take their knowledge and you can create success in your life, not only for yourself as a caregiver, but for your loved one who is on the fetal alcohol spectrum. We can create good people, great good humans, and we don't have to live going from crisis to crisis to crisis to crisis to crisis. So to avoid that, that's why you're here. So you can listen to some folks who have been through it. You could learn from them, pick up what they are doing right, try to avoid that learning curve of the mistakes they've made. We can all do our best. So speaking of doing our best, how you doing? How the heck are you? Where are you listening? Where are you right now as you listen? You should let me know because, again, I've already said this a few times, but somebody said they listened to this in the shower. That's wild. I dig it, though. Like, where else are you listening to it? Are you in a bunker somewhere, right? Is that you have a respite bunker, and that's where you are listening to this, smashing some snacks and getting your learn on? That's what I like to see. It has been an absolute amazing couple of weeks. I don't know if you know, but we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/FASD success. And every day, oh my gosh, pushing 3 weeks, if not over 3 weeks now, I have been going live every single day and doing what's called FASD Quick Tips. The feedback has been amazing. The comments and people are sharing it and digging it. And so I'm digging it. And the more people like it, the more it makes me just want to keep on teaching. It's some good positive motivation when you're sitting there with a camera in your face or a microphone in your face. And you're like, is this going to work? People are going to like this. Is it going to be value? And you know, back in your head, you're like, of course it is. Because every time you talk about it, people love to hear about it. So I really appreciate it. And if you want to check those out, please do, buddy. What else is going on? We are in the dead set right now of summertime. I am super excited about today's episode. Today's episode is with Annette Kunzman, and she is one of the co-founders and now the current president of the FASD Network of Southern California in Los Angeles is where she lives. And the only reason I know that is because I went there. You might have heard me reference this before, but in 2015, I did a tour. And what I did with that tour is all I did was put an email out to, because I have an email list. If you're not on, we could totally put the link in the description. So I have a newsletter list, have it for years and years, and I just asked, hey, is anybody interested? I was looking to do a tour, and lo and behold, there was like close to 40, and we were able to fit in 34, I believe, just with logistics and all that. And Los Angeles was on the docket, and I met herself and her husband Doug and their kid David. I stayed at their house because, you know, that's what you got to do. It's like being a band on the road, right? Stay at people's houses, stay at motels, whatever it took to get in front of people, because, you know, people need FASD education, and that's what I do. So anyways, talk to her. She's an amazing lady, great story with her kids. So as you know, I use the podcast to basically catch up with people who I've had great conversations with before, for the most part, and she's no different. We ended up having this conversation about transitioning into adulthood. Both of her boys just were on that cusp when I met them a few years ago. But now to get updates on both of their kids, and she's very raw, very real, doesn't pull any punches, which I believe is the best way, just to be as honest as possible so that you, the listener, when you're listening to this, you feel that it's possible. Does that make sense? Like, you're like, okay, if this lady who's done all this great work and is A, still surviving, her kids are still alive, then this could happen for me. And it's not always perfect, and it's not always sunshine and rainbows. But the whole point of my mission and my company's mission is to help people have better days, more good days. And if you're able to do that, that's a win. And she just drops information. She tells you what it's like, what to look out for, lessons that she's learned. So you're really going to appreciate it. And I, in fact, you know what, dudes? I think we should just go there. So I hope you're doing well. I'm doing well. We're all alive. Everybody's listening to this. So let's dive into Annette a little bit. So check this lady out, okay? Because she is cool. So basically, Annette co-founded the FASD Network of Southern California in 2010 and was integral in establishing it as a 501(c)(3) nonprofit organization in 2014. She has served as secretary of the network, treasurer, and now she is the president. If you did not know, Annette holds a master's in management degree from Northwestern University's J.L. Kellogg Graduate School of Management and received her undergraduate degree at the University of Nebraska, where she was named the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society. She was certified as a chartered financial analyst in 1998 by the Institute of Chartered Financial Analysts. Following a long career in commercial lending and investment management, Annette retired from the Oak Tree Capital Management High Yield Bonded Group in 2006 in order to take care of both of her boys. She's done so much more. This, I'm telling you, she knows what's going on. So enough about me. Let's listen to the lady speak and make sure you got a pen and a piece of paper handy because she's about to hold court. So, all right, let's have a go. Let's get to the interview. Let's go. Today, folks, I have someone very special for you. In about in 2015, I went on a tour and I was basically a vagabond. This was one of the stops, Los Angeles. I am with Annette Kunzman. From the
FASD Network of Southern California.
I blew it, but people expect that of me now. Annette, thank you so much for joining me, man. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure to be here with you, Jeff.
It's great to see you again.
Yes, I must say.
For those who are listening, we're also on video, so I could see people's lips. But again, I had an amazing time going across the United States in 2015, and it was all community-based, and they stepped up, and I stayed at your house with your husband and your kid, and you guys are amazing people, and we've kept the connection ever since, and I love it. But you're also doing really big things. You are the president of the
FASD Network of Southern California.
Bingo. So you're the president of the FASD Network of Southern California, but you're also a caregiver. You're a mom. Yeah. Can you take me back, man? I love doing origin stories.
Well, after a number of years of trying to have our own children, my husband and I decided to go the adoption route. And I was working full time and I had a big job. So we went the private adoption way. Unlike many people who adopted their children. And because I couldn't, you know, given my full-time work, I couldn't foster children. So we did a private adoption and we adopted our oldest son, who's now 27, as an infant. So we did a private. You know, you don't get much story. You find some of these lawyers that are involved with this are basically acting like brokers, you know. So that was kind of a rough experience. We learned from that. So the next time around, we went with a social agency, an adoption agency in Southern California, and we were able to use them as the intermediary. And we were able to then adopt our second son, who's now 23, through the agency. So basically, the parents relinquished their rights to the adoption agency, and then they placed the baby with us. So it was a much more, civil experience.
Yeah, that's fair to say. So the first experience didn't sit right in terms of how it was structured. Like you said, it was more of a brokerage, right? Like, but you were younger, and was there just you wanted?
Right. Again, this was 20, we're going on, you know, the process takes a while. So going back 30 years ago, this was before internet, right?
Right.
maybe internet was around, but I mean, yes, there was internet, but didn't have the resources, didn't have the information as people do now. So it's kind of in the back, the old days.
No social history, nothing said about FASD.
No. The only comment on the first child was the birth mother said that she was separated from her husband and that he was an alcoholic. That was the only kind of reference that we had. Both of them, of course, were smokers. And we knew with the second one that there were drugs involved because I eventually got the birth records. And so there was drugs involved, but no word of alcohol. And I don't think the doctors at then, certainly when I took the children to the pediatricians, there was no question. You know, they didn't even mention the possibility or the issue of the exposures that the children may have had. You know, they examined them physically and said, oh, they're keepers, et cetera.
So. When did you notice something was different off? Did you know? When did the symptoms of the disability present themselves in your first guy?
The first guy. I can look back now with all the knowledge that I have, I can look back and I can see the signs. At that time, first child, you know, didn't know. Of course, I had a full-time nanny. And, you know, so there are things that, you know, I blamed myself, you know, over the years, parents kicked themselves over and over again for missing some things. But I can look back and see he had trouble, you know, going to sleep at night. You know, I would rock him to sleep, but as soon as I put him down, he'd be awake and he'd be awake, you know, a fair amount. So sleep issues, I noticed, sensory issues, big time. And when I could see and look back on the playtime, he couldn't, not like other children who can just sit and play with toys. He would just be throwing them, you know, puzzles were an anathema. You know, he just couldn't put a puzzle together that just was, you know, and then the early 3-4 years old, the early drawings were just really scribbles, you know, for him to try to draw a human face. So there's things that I could see. And obviously when we were looking for preschools, there are things that they could see, and trying to get into kindergartens, we were living in a place where the public schools weren't very good. So we were looking at private schools and none of the private schools would take him.
What are you thinking now? Are you going to the pediatrician? Or are you you're saying, what is up with this?
Yeah. I mostly was trying to get him healthy. You know, because I could see the sensory things. So then, okay, allergies. Having allergies was a whole new world for me. All this medical, you know, I grew up healthy. My family was healthy. I didn't know anything about allergies. So I was trying to get him healthy. We lived in Pasadena. The allergies in the summer were really bad. So I was just trying to get him as healthy as possible and getting the sleep. So I was really more focused on the physical aspect. And then at the age of 5, when it was time for him to enter kindergarten, we decided to move to Manhattan Beach, which is closer to the ocean. The air quality is so much better and they have great public schools. So that's why we moved to Manhattan.
So that's the move. And for those our international audience, Manhattan Beach is in Los Angeles, California. And it was awesome when I was there because I was like, this is straight up from Grand Theft Auto. Like, this is straight up. I'm right here from the video game. Anyways, that's the gamers will get that. So you move there not for like the surf and the surfing and you move there for air quality for your boy. That makes sense.
Primarily. Well, and my husband is does like the ocean and surf. And we'd go to the beach all the time and so did our oldest son. So, I mean, he loved beach camp, for example. So, you know, there were a whole variety of reasons. That was one of them.
Someone said FASD.
Not until fourth grade.
Oh my gosh. Was it a nightmare at home or are we surviving? Like, I'm not trying to paint a horrible picture, but I'm just trying to say, like, I fostered knowing my guy was on the spectrum. You're a new parent. It's now 4 years.
What was hard was the sleep up in the middle of the night. He was up constantly.
Yeah.
And that was the sleep was an issue. We had a fantastic nanny. I mean, she's still part of our family. I mean, all the holidays are with her. She comes with us.
Yeah.
We had a great nanny. She was wonderful with him. I just thought he was an energetic boy. I just thought he was being a high energy boy. But school, there were issues, reading, learning to read. And I remember when in second grade or first grade, when you're learning to read, he'd say, "Mom, the teacher says to visualize." He says, "I can't visualize." Mm-hmm. And now I look, listen to the words. They're telling you, right? They are telling you what's going on.
Wow.
"I can't visualize, Mom. I can't." So those were signs. So then I'm asking, and of course I got a lot of pushback from the teachers. They didn't want to get involved with, it's an IEP process, the individualized education plan, education process in the United States. They didn't want to get involved with that. So I had to push, and I finally forced the school to have a meeting, and the school psychologist did an evaluation of him, and, he didn't qualify for special education. But he did under the what they call the other health impaired. So we went to UCLA, and of course the first diagnosis was, ADHD combination form. But the school psychologist, after the meeting, informally presented me with the brochure on FASD. Ah. And on this brochure is that face, right? The 1 in 10, that face. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, Some of those symptoms seemed right, but at least she planted the seed. And I know I was in denial for a long time.
Sure.
She planted the seed. And of course, we went on the trials of medication. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Then we did an outside evaluation. And it was in the outside evaluation that she said, "Look, his left side of his brain is really impacted. You are always going to have to be, he's always going to be a moth to the flame. You are always going to have to be there, you're going to have to be involved with his girlfriend. You're going to have to help pick out his spouse." So this was fifth grade. And so this was an outside evaluator that we paid for. And so then we knew that after fifth grade, when you go to middle school, we were not sending him to the public middle school, that he needed to go to a more contained classroom. So we paid for a new private school, and it was maybe 8-10 students in the class. And he was there for a year. He did okay. It was fine. Unfortunately, the teacher was one of these. She feels that life is, you're juggling balls and you have to learn how to catch them. So she was not necessarily, it wasn't routine. And he really needed structure and a routine. So that didn't work. So we started the long trial of non-public schools. Mm-hmm. When he became a teenager, we're having so many issues that I gave up my career. I retired.
And I want the audience to know, because you're talking nannies and private schools, you're not living in a palatial estate on Manhattan Beach, right? Like, So I don't want people to say, "Oh, she had this and that, this and
No. I was a working mom. I had a big job. I made a lot of money.
Yeah.
But we've lived, relatively. I mean, we live in a nice neighborhood. Yeah. But we're paupers compared to most of the people in our community. Truly I gave up the equity in the firm, which is was the big killer. And I loved what I did. So that was really, really hard to do, but family comes first. So
but was there a grief and loss in that? Giving this up, what you were.
Oh, huge. Really, really big. I still have dreams about it. It still affects me years later. And I retired in 2006, so 14 years ago.
Well, thank you thanks for sharing. Because I just think about people listening to this who have to quit their careers and, put the things on hold for their families and how hard that is.
Yes.
People say, "Oh, look at you, like a martyr almost," right? And you're like, I would have preferred not to do that.
Exactly. Yeah. And, because kids who are neurotypical, they can adjust. I mean, it's the schedule. They... Like I always tell teachers, particularly in good schools like that are in my community, it's the students that make the teachers look good, because the students are all bright. They all come from these high achieving families. Yeah. And the teachers think they're these wonderful, wonderful teachers. Well, it's the kids that make them look good. I don't know whether you're a good teacher until you can teach the children that have special requirements.
100%. It's, you know, being in Canada, hockey's the big sport here. And they always say, like, you want to see a good coach because they have good players. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, the players are making the coach. Right? It's kind of the same deal. When did we relinquish? When did we submit? When did we to the fact of it, this might be FASD?
My children didn't get their diagnoses until they were, oldest was 18 and the youngest was 14.
Take me through that, man. Like, when did you say, okay, because you've obviously did, like, all the other people, medications, different treatments.
And I can't tell you how many parenting classes my husband and I went to. You know, the schools would say, what's going on at home?
Because you think it's you.
Between you and your husband, right?
Because you, and then the narrative is, it's like what you're doing. It's your fault as a parent.
Yes. Right. The second child, really, really high verbal IQ. But when when he was about in fourth grade, I finally said to you, no, there's some things going on with him. Maybe I should have him evaluated by this, you know, an independent evaluator, and found out that he very high IQ, but his working processing memory was in the 10th percentile.
Super low. I know David. He's a magician on the computer, man. Literally, when I was with you, I spent 6 hours with him, and I was just like, show me what you got. Like, it's amazing.
This was like, you know, elementary school, and he was, you know, shutting down on certain things like math. He couldn't do the minute math where they have a, you know, 60 seconds you got to do.
Mad minute. I know.
You know, he'd just shut down. He'd freeze. So you could see those things. So I started suspecting. And so, but he, because he's so bright, his verbal IQ was, you know, very high. Yeah. He, in middle school, so we tried public middle school with him, and he was depressed and anxious and almost suicidal. So fortunately, they had a very good principal, and she got very involved from the very beginning. But we were getting into school refusal with him. So with both of the kids, we were struggling with almost different issues because they are kind of night and day as far as personalities. So we were being pulled in so many different directions, which again is why I needed to retire and just try to, you know, work, sort it out. You know, just be there full time, because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do everything. So
like when the oldest got evaluated at 18,
we got lucky. By then I'd gotten involved with other women other parents in Southern California. So that was about 10 years ago. So they would have been, you know, they would have been 13 and 16, 17 at the time. I got involved with other parents when I started figuring it out. And I talked to some experts. So I called some expert, and I wanted to know whether it was appropriate to get an evaluation or not. And they're kind of like, well, if it walks like
a duck,
then treat it like that, you know, and just pull up your big girl panties and, you know, deal with it kind of messages that I would get. And then Dr. Mary O'Connor at UCLA got a grant to do a study. And you've probably heard her present her study, but we were able to get both boys evaluated at UCLA without, for once, didn't have to pay for a study or evaluation.
Right.
So it was through that grant that we were able to have both boys evaluated. Definitely the oldest one much more affected, and the younger one, you know, less so.
What's the feeling like when it comes back? Yeah, this is, you know, the FASD.
By then, not a surprise. You know what? Not a surprise. And certainly some of the physical markers that were present were something that I just thought were part of them. I didn't realize that was a marker of, you know, the exposure. So by then, I think through all the other evaluations we had, it wasn't a surprise, but at least now I could say to them, you know, and I had been saying to my younger one all along, the oldest one, I would say, you know, these troubles you're having in school, I said, I think it's because, you know, and your birth mother never wanted to harm you. She would never have, but she probably didn't realize that when she would drink, that it could cause problems for you. And so I had planted the seed, you know, and it took them particularly the younger one, it took a long time for them to begin to accept that this is their diagnosis. But I didn't try to hide it from them. I tried to give them a reason for why they struggled. And I explained
that. That's excellent, because I get that often. How do you talk to your kids about it? You're in a position unique in terms of now you have two like adulthood, like they're,
and now they're young adults.
They're not living at home, correct?
The oldest one is living in Colorado, has now for a number of years. The youngest one just moved back home.
Oh, so what was that like? So not, see, it's not like you're going to move down the street, Mom. I'm going to move to Colorado.
Very hard. Yeah. He just needed to get out of California. I mean, we have been through the ringer with the oldest one. Fortunately, not drugs, which was one of my concerns. But he is definitely grandiose in his ideas. He was the one that would rent Ferraris. He rented Maybachs. I mean, he would talk these Beverly Hills Rent-A-Car into renting him these things. You know, and he was 20 years old. I mean, no credit. I mean, it's just one of these great talker, great salesmen. And then once he turned 18, 19, he started trying to buy cars. You know, these schlocky car dealers would help him fill out these forms. You know, and he'd be signing car loans, 30% interest rates. It was a nightmare.
Oh my goodness.
So we were a lot with him. And so he had to get out of California.
Yeah.
People were after him. Creditors were after him. You know, people who had loaned him money. Hey, if you give me your money, I can invest it. I can invest it in penny stocks.
And just sound so expressive, the expressive language, right?
Oh, he could talk the talk.
Which is a strength, but then the rest of the systems don't align with the expressive language. So
when they turn 18, they can sign contracts, right? And the credit cards companies come after them. Sure.
Yeah.
Credit for $1,000. Never. I'll charge it up, not thinking that it's going to have to be paid back.
How is he doing now?
He's doing better. I mean, there is maturity. Definitely there's maturity. And he's really come to kind of own his weaknesses. He has said, Mom, why do I always have to learn things the hard way? Mm. You know, I know you told me this, Dad told me this, but I had to, you know, learn it from myself. So he thinks he's learned his lesson and then he does it again. And so he's kind of reconciling that he's always going to need some help. He has for a long time worried about the health of me and my husband, you know, because he really does worry about when we're not here. And he's really trying to get to the point where he can carry on in life without the help of Mom and Dad.
Which is a great aspiration.
Right.
Who doesn't want that?
Right.
You know, and are you having these conversations with him? He said, you tell me this. Dad tells me this. I still do this. Do we have the conversation about the primary, one of the primary symptoms being a natural and logical consequences, struggling with that?
Yes, yes, yes. The thing, so even though he lives in Colorado, I have to say, it's less so now because he's actually been doing some work and he's busier and he has some more friends. He's got a roommate that he doesn't see very often, but at least he's not by himself.
Yeah.
In the early days, I spent hours every day on the phone with him. I mean, an hour at a time, several times a day. So even though I'm in California, he's Colorado, I spend hours on the phone. And he and my husband have gotten involved with a business. We, you know, we've tried to help him start up different businesses. You know, he's worked with other companies, but again, it's hard for people with this issue to get a job and maintain a job. And right. Even though in Colorado, marijuana is legal.
Yep.
A lot of companies are regulated by the feds. And so if you smoke marijuana, you can't get hired.
That's kind of ass backwards a bit.
It is. It very much so is. It's like it's legal in the state. And, you know, and the part is, you know, and my son is so smart. He's like, he says, how is it that somebody who drinks alcohol, who goes get wasted over the weekend and goes hungover, he can go get the job. But he goes in hungover the next day, so he's not productive. But someone who smoked marijuana a month ago, it's still in their system and they can't get the job.
That is kind of weird.
It's not.
Anyways, so you trying to get him involved. Another point I want to touch on, you said they slowly came to an understanding of the disability. What was that slowly understanding? Was there anger, denial, was there grief and loss in there too?
Oh, absolutely. My oldest has experienced all those emotions. The younger one tends to keep to himself. He really didn't accept the diagnosis in the beginning, but he does recognize that he's got memory issues or problems with his memory. He really can't remember, but he'll remember that mom, like yesterday he came to me, mom, you know how you always told me that if I wanted a book, that you would always buy me books. So he needed like $35 to buy two books.
I was like, yeah, that's good.
How is it that you remember that? I said that a long time ago.
Because then we learn the difference between long-term memory and short-term memory, right? Once something gets in there, it's always in there. So, because this is a catch-up for me. So, folks, you're listening to this at home because I'm curious. Mm-hmm. He was at home when I was with you.
Right.
What was his transition like?
So, we tried to go through the public school and we tried to work with the public school, but then they're the one, they wanted to send him to a psychiatric residential school because he was doing school refusal. We really didn't want to. We said, can't we do sort of a wraparound where we provide all these services, but you bring him to the home? We really didn't want to go to a boarding situation, but we thought we'd try to work with the school. Well, our oldest one went to a residential setting also for a couple of years. I found with those residential settings, for the ones at least that we experienced, the schools were really great. They were really good with kids who had learning differences. They were fantastic. I love the schools. The residential setting was the issue because, again, people fell back to the chart systems, the behavioral systems, the step programs, et cetera. And those just failed miserably. So we ended up settling with the school for our youngest with going to a private setting, a one-on-one. So he got to finish his high school with an organization called Fusion Academy, where he was taught, he would go and meet with his teacher for an hour, and then he'd do an hour of homework, and that was like three times a week. Different teachers, different classes, and that's how he, finished high school. And it took him till he was age 19, I think, before he finished, but he could do it at his own pace. And then he signed up for, we have a occupational school for all of the local high schools, and he decided he wanted to go into welding. And so he took classes at a trade school for welding. And that's when he decided, since he was going to, college, that he needed his own apartment. And that was his motivation to get a driver's license.
Does he have a driver's license?
Yes, he does. Both of them.
No way.
Yeah.
Not that like he's not capable. That's just like, I'm just learning, because I met him and now that's cool that he's, and do you find maturity in him? And
Yes, and no.
Yeah.
Taking the test obviously for him was a piece of cake. That driving for him, what's hard is the visual spatial,
Gotcha. How many car lengths, yeah.
But fortunately, helping them with a vehicle, making sure that they got all the latest features on with how to
park. That beeps when you're too close.
And all that helps a lot.
That's very
visual spatial and, how to angle this vehicle. It took some scratches and some dents.
They could get there. It just takes longer.
Takes a little longer. Exactly. And he didn't get his license till he was 20. So both of them, I think both of them were at least 19 or 20 before they got their licenses.
Because I remember I was going from your place to Arizona and I being from Canada, I was like, I wonder what it's like to drive across the desert. And then I should have only done it for 10 minutes because was the next 7 hours.
Yeah.
It was so hot. It was so hot. I couldn't even roll down my window. Cause usually anywhere in the planet, if it's hot, you can still roll down your window and get a breeze. I was rolling down my window and it was like the life was sucked out of me. And if I didn't have air conditioning anyway, I would have been like this with the birds flying over me. Yeah. Right. The old poor Canadian boy. Cause people are listening. They have younger kids. Mm-hmm. What would you tell someone who is approaching transition age with their kids? What are some of the things that you learned that you could help maybe with their learning curve that you do like some big things that jumped out at you?
It's so hard. And because each one is so individual. For example, our oldest wanted so much to be an adult. I mean, when he was young, like say 6 years old, he's like, what? Oh, or I think when he was six, he said to me, what's the point of being born if you can't be born 16 at age 16?
Mm-hmm. All right.
Can't you be just born 16? Because not until you're 16, you can't drive, you can't light a match, and you can't have a knife.
Right? Right? Like, why am I have to deal with all this?
Right? Let's just get to the end point. So he was always wanting to be there, you know. So I can give you all kinds of advice, but if you've got a kid that wants to be out there, he says, I'm 18 in the eyes of the world, I'm 18. I'm going to.
So he wanted to go, but weren't you scared about where he was functionally, like worried about that? Because there's a caregiver that I'm thinking about right now who's their kids at home. He is like a young adult. He wants to go. They're scared. My advice was to try and help them do it as safely as possible, but keeping them there, right, would almost be detrimental.
Yeah. They kind of, you know, it's painful as a parent to let them go, but sometimes you have to. And I think, you know, I think we've given our oldest son a little too much rope, you know. Sure. He hasn't hung himself yet, but he's had a pretty long rope, and right. So I feel like maybe we should have kept a tighter rein. He wouldn't have gotten in so much trouble, and it probably wouldn't have been such a financial drain on us. Uh-huh. With him, to help him, he had to get all these creditors, you know, after him. He had to know what it's like to have creditors calling you and have people angry with you, taking him to civil court, and all these things for him to learn that, you know, that he couldn't handle it. And so I had got financial guardianship. I got guardianship over him. Mm-hmm. And so he had to go through that process. And then as a guardian, I could take him through bankruptcy, and having to go through bankruptcy court was really, really tough.
Wow.
Hard on him. And then he had to go through a credit course afterwards. And as part of that, he heard all these things and he repeated back all these things that my husband and I had told him over the years, but because it was coming from this other source, he listened to them. It's not an easy thing. The one thing I would tell someone whose child is transitioning is be aware that they're going to be subject to all these solicitations for credit cards. You know, my kid was so savvy on those things and would take advantage of them, but I would try to protect him from that. I would try to open up a joint bank account, you know, so that they can learn how to try to handle the money. Still, our younger child with the bank account, you know, he doesn't track how much money is in there, and oops, it's overdrawn.
Yeah.
You know, or I can't tell you how many times I've gotten a call, Mom, I'm at the checkout line, I'm at the grocery store, I need money in my bank account. You know, then there's just the not planning ahead.
Is he open? Because we know individuals on the spectrum have trouble with money. Like that's, you know, that's math, that's money, that's numbers. Is he open to, you know, here's your bills are taken care of, this is what's left for food and entertainment? Or is this just your philosophy is like, as he matures and gets older, he will adapt to this? Like,
yeah, I think mine is more the latter. David has still not, you know, we never finished the story. He went to welding school, etc., but he never got a job. And then he went to a trade school this last year, a different trade school. And that was pretty successful. He's got a few certificates, but then of course the COVID hit, and he started a few jobs and then he's quit. He was either too fast paced.
Yeah.
If it's assembly line type of work, he can't. It's just too fast paced. You know, for a long time he wanted to be a chef. He worked in a one man show. I mean, three people working in this little cafe. It was still too exacting for him. It's hard for them to find the right environment. So. Yeah, with this COVID thing, we just said move home. You know, for now, it's temporary.
Yeah, that's right. Just move back in until, you know, things open up again and out you can go. So he doesn't feel like he's stuck or he failed or exactly. Yeah, this is circumstantial.
Yeah, because, I mean, there are so many adult kids home right now. You know, I said, look, this is so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. There's so many kids that are home. They might be working remotely, but they're home with their parents. So I said, it's just time to do that. So, but again, the money thing is hard, you know, because he doesn't have an income right now. And so we get a lot, you know, with him, it's easier. We can kind of monitor it and he doesn't ask for much. He doesn't need much. So David, it's not quite the issue, but he does, his bills do get paid and he really does kind of need someone to pay him. So pay his bills and take care of that for him. So it's just something I worry about going down the road. The older one is learning and he was taking on more and more of that responsibility and doing quite well. He drives for Uber and Lyft. And for the longest time, he wasn't able to, first of all, they weren't doing it. And now, you know, I think he's been sick a couple times this spring, fortunately not COVID. But he's been very sick, so he hasn't been able to drive. So, you know, his income is sort of spotty, right?
Yeah.
But he is learning to manage over time. He still is not quite aware of how much he really spends because so many of his bills are taken care of, you know, by us.
Understood. Mm-hmm. And that's, so you're protecting and letting them grow and nurture. And do you face backlash? Did you face backlash from other people, other parents with your style?
Oh, no, maybe because I don't share too much. You know, over the years, you just become more isolated. You know, it, you just become a little bit more isolated and I just don't share that much. You know?
That's fair. Except now with the world, but that's fine. How'd you maintain your own sanity, man? How did you maintain your own psyche?
Oh, it's hard. It's really hard. I did finally, probably after I retired, I finally did get my own therapist who's a social worker. And we do it remotely now. She started earlier because she moved to Seattle, but she knows FASD, et cetera. So I finally got my own therapist and I went on an antidepressant because, you know, there are days I couldn't get out of bed. And even though I could get out of bed, I would just force myself, right? Because I think we're all sort of suffering from PTSD. So I think I highly recommend any caregiver who, you know, you think you're being strong, et cetera, but, you know, you do have to take care of yourself. And it took me a long time to understand that part of taking care of yourself is perhaps getting some therapy and also some medication if necessary.
Absolutely. Because
go ahead.
Yeah, because in the midst of the symptoms, there's lots of uncertainty. There's lots of anger, frustration, rage. So I'd say caregivers are akin to a frontline worker. I mean, not a frontline, like a first responder, mm-hmm. You know, where something is happening. Your brain is like, this is dangerous. I need to get out of here. And you have to trick your fight or flight so much. You're like, not only do I not run, but I have to now be calm and de-escalate this person who's being loud and boisterous and it's unsettling to me. That's, I could totally get the PTSD part.
Oh yeah. But so now what I do is I actually belong to a couple book clubs. I've always loved to read. I mean, in the ideal world, I would have been an English teacher or an English professor. That's what I would have preferred to do. So I read a lot and I walk. I just got my left hip replaced.
I know. Like, how are you feeling with that?
I'm doing really great. It's good now. The right one needs to
feel good.
Yeah. Oh, I can walk. You know, I'm limited by my right hip now. So that's the problem. So my flexibility is coming back. It's just amazing. 6 weeks after the surgery, it's incredible how well I'm doing. It's amazing.
Do you have to get the other one done?
Yeah. The next one as soon as I can. Maybe this fall or January when the hospitals, I'm lucky that I got my hip done when the hospitals were open because they're closing again, you know, for elective surgeries. So I'm definitely January at the latest. I'm hoping for the right one to get done.
This is what is remarkable about you. And thank you for sharing and being open. And this is so beneficial for the people listening. But you're the president of the FASD Network of Southern California. So, but you know, you're dealing with your kids full time What made you want to now get into this arena and, you know, help with an organization? You know, how'd you start that with all that was going on?
Well, a part of it, honestly, was just for the support. I mean, initially, that's what we did, which is because you find that the caregivers are the ones that know the most about how to deal with our children. And so it was a way to get together, provide support, you know, try this, try that. Oh, yeah, you too, me too. You know, because when I go out with girls' night, right, with my girlfriends, you know, all they talk about is how successful their kids are on the sports mm-hmm. and which college they got into and now what great jobs they have. And you listen to this all in all and they complain about this and that and thinking, you don't have enough problems.
Right. You let me open my mouth.
Children, it's really, really beneficial to be with people that know what you're going through. And that's the initial reason I did it. And then, of course, I had the resources to be able to start going to the FASD International Research Conference up in Canada. I think the first one I went to was in 2008. So just learning as much as I could and then wanting to be able to share it with other people who were starting to go through the same things and hopefully prevent them from making mistakes that I made. But anyway, so we decided we needed to form as a nonprofit organization so that we could handle money, so that we could, you know, rate, you know, charge fees. So we could pay our speakers and pay for their travel expenses. And so we found that we've gotten very good at that. I was the treasurer before. I've been the secretary and the treasurer, and now I'm the president. I had to give up those titles in order to be president, but we are vendored with, the developmental department, the group in the state of California that's supposed to provide help to families with children with developmental disabilities. So we're vendored with them so that we can get some of our conferences. They will pay for their parents to go mm-hmm. to conferences. So we've been doing a lot of that work. So we've been networking with the other organizations like the State Council on Developmental Disabilities, the regional centers, and other organizations. So I think where we've been most effective besides providing support to parents is by connecting with these other social organizations that are providing counseling and help to parents. And also we've put on several good conferences on dealing with the schools, what kind of support services to get for your children, you know, and understanding what the regulations are in the states and in the state of California. So understanding what the local resources are and how you can get the right support services for your child in the schools.
I also know you have a Facebook page, and I'll make sure I put all of that information up as well. You guys have a closed group for parents?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. We have a closed group, right?
And so are you, because it seems like you're building momentum on your page, that's for sure. What is your vision for the future of the FASD Network of Southern California?
You know, my vision is it changing. In fact, when I was waiting in the guest room,
yeah,
no. I was kind of outlining the agenda for the next board meeting, and that's one of the things that I want to go back to because times have changed. We can't have our support meetings in person. We can't give out the hugs that we like to give. We can't go to the resource fairs and hand out information. So I want to develop a curriculum that we can be providing to different groups, like to schools or to the police force. To social workers, et cetera. So I want to develop a curriculum that we can either do webinars or, you know, online training. We'd already signed a contract to provide trainings to a group in LA where they want every single one of their social workers to be trained on FASD.
Nice.
So we'll, you know, we're all kind of in the early stages of how we convert to this new world. And so, that's one of the things that we're working on, where we can really just provide local training in the Southern California is 10 counties, okay? And that encompasses LA County and Orange County and San Diego County, which are huge. These are huge counties, and it's 60% of the population of California. So that's 24 million people.
That's like we're 37 million in our whole country, just to give you a perspective.
Yeah. So Southern California, 24 million. So obviously we can't be everywhere. So I would love to see more local support groups. And we're starting to see some of those spring up in certain areas like Baker's, like Fresno, for example. And the other thing that we're doing is coordinating with other groups throughout the state. And what we were really building momentum on before this all hit was getting a California FASD task force established by our legislator. So we have been, the NOFAS Northern California wrote a position paper on establishing an FASD task force. And so we've been soliciting and getting letters of support for that. And we'd wanted to go, and we'd planned to go to Sacramento to get some legislators to sponsor that. So that's kind of our next big step. I'm reaching back out to Northern California to find out where we are in that process. But again, you know, Sacramento's closed right now. So,
well, it sounds like you have quite the job, but it sounds like you have, a vision too, and you're working on pivoting. And because it is a whole new world that we're dealing with, So what does somebody do? Like, how does somebody reach you? What is the best way to get a hold of the FASD Network of Southern California?
What you can do is reach me at Annette K, that's A-N-N-E-T-T-E-K, at FASDSoCalNetwork.org.
Beautiful. And then I'm going to, in our show notes, of course, we always will put up all the information as well. Now, my last couple of questions. Go ahead. Floor is yours.
Sorry. I'll give you my cell phone number. Call me.
We'll put it down. Absolutely. You know what? Say it. Are you cool with saying it? Because there might be a weirdo or two. But go ahead if you want to give your cell phone.
310-717-9763.
Be respectful. Don't call Annette at 3 a.m. in a crisis. That is a preference that I have to preface that.
Okay, I keep my phone on silent. So
you know all the tricks with the kids for sure.
Yeah.
Where you're at? Are you happy with where things are at? Like where your family's at? Where things are at? Despite everything that's been happening, like that's happened and gone on. Like, how are you feeling about your family unit right now?
We move forward and I'm feeling pretty good. And then something hits you, like, you know, yesterday I found something out and it just knocks you back, you know? So it's some steps forward and then something will kind of throw you back and you're back in it. So
how do you rebound from that?
It's hard. I mean, this is taking me a little bit. So this was, you know, I'm probably not going
to
say.
Right. You don't have to. Yeah. You're under no obligation to. Shitty happened.
You get to the point where like you're pretty happy, but you know the shoe's going to drop. You know, but I'm happy. My boys are still alive. Mm-hmm. There's no. I'm grateful. There's no addictions.
Yep.
There's no families. I mean, there's no children.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for so many things, right? And I'm grateful that we've had the resources to help them when they've needed help. There's so much that I'm grateful for. I can't tell you. Do I want things to be better? Of course, right? You know, the hardest part is that they're both so lonely. They don't have friends. I mean, my oldest son has some sort of casual friends, but the youngest one has no friends, none. He's got his cat. He's got us, but that's it. And that's the hardest part.
But he's a gamer, right?
He's a gamer. Yeah, you're right. And he's got, and the thing that's different about him from the oldest is that he can entertain himself. He loves weed. He loves gaming. He likes, you know.
But is there a community? Does he interact with a community online?
I guess so.
All I'm trying to do is give you the hope that he might not be as lonely as it looks like on the outside.
Could be. That is,
you know?
You're right. I might be projecting my feelings on him. Right. You know, and he doesn't necessarily act, you know, he doesn't appear to be, you know, so, and I used to worry about how much he games, et cetera. And I did feel judged. You mentioned that before. I did feel judged for how much I let him game and just do that. But my feeling was, you know what? He is entertained. I know where he is and I know he's safe.
He loves it. People, like, that's was I've I'm a gamer, so I had no problem. He's like, do you want to see my stuff? I'm like, yes. And in fact, I called him when I was building my computer. Right? Like, I remember I said, what's his, how do I get in touch with him? So he gave me feedback. He loves it. Like, it's a hobby. People love it. It's what they do, and it's immersive and all that good stuff. So I could be biased on that end as well. But here's my last question. People are listening to this. They're burnt. They're broken. They're like, geez, my kid's 5, 6. I don't know how I can make it to this age. What if someone is sitting there in front of you? What is your advice to them?
I would, reach out. I mean, really find a support group. I can't tell you how many people I speak to who are having issues and I feel like I'm not helping them at all. You know, I feel like I'm really grasping for some answers or something, but then they're so appreciative. They said, oh, I remember what you said. I have Annette's voice in my head. So I would really try to find a mentor or, you know, someone who's been there. I would reach out because there are people who have been there and they can give you hope. I mean, things will get better. I mean, they might get worse until they get better, but there is hope and, you know, these aren't, but I would focus on their strengths and focus on the relationship. I try to let a lot of things go. Don't take things personally. You cannot take things personally. What they say, what they do to you, you can't take it personally. Just recognize that it's their disability and really try to, really focus on the relationship. And I think once you kind of focus on trying to understand their feelings, let them talk to you and for them, parents worrying about transitioning, make sure that they feel comfortable telling you things. Don't react. Cause I used to go, so then they didn't.
Yes.
So I think through it all, focus on the relationship, build on their strengths, never take away something that they love doing and support their weaknesses and really try to understand where their weaknesses are and get a mentor, find somebody or a group that you can call on.
Beautifully said, buddy. The FASD Network of Southern California is in good hands as you as a president. I am so glad that I met you in my journey. I'm glad we're able to connect like this. I can't wait to see what you do in the future because you are a doer. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, man, for not only letting me stay at your house, but just being such a champion for the FASD cause. Will you come back and do this again sometime?
I'd love to.
And I'd love to have you. Thanks so much, dude. I really appreciate you being here.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
This is what I love so much about the show, honestly. I did not expect to go to that area in terms of transition and talking about transition. You know, in fact, I use these to catch up, right? Honestly, to catch up with folks who I've run into. And I just want to thank Annette again for sharing that. Like, that's a very honest and open answer she was giving and about the struggles with transitioning and what it was like in the early days and all that she went through. So I really appreciate how, you know, most of our guests are all open and honest, and I think that's what affects us the most. And it also makes us feel better to know that look at all that she's achieved, both academically and, business wise, but to still be human enough to just be like us and have the struggles just like we do, just like you might when you are helping your kid transition or if your kid is beginning the transition. I think she gave a lot of good tips and set a lot of appropriate expectations and stuff you could avoid and stuff you could absolutely do. So thank you very much, Annette. I just want to touch on a few things just to put an extra emphasis, an extra focus, because a lot of the things I think she said was super important. But especially in the start, I was a foster parent. I have never been an adoptive parent. So I could only imagine when you hear, you know, we tried so long to have a kid and it just didn't happen. And I'm sure there's grief and loss associated with that, right? You wanted to have a biological kid, just wasn't working. We have to grieve those losses and start to focus other places to have a child, to have a family, because that's a need, that's a want for a majority of us. And then to not get told anything about the social history of the child, or to have it just glazed over and minimized. And then you want a child so bad, and you finally get this child and you adopt this child, and then you find out there's a disability on top of that. So there's layers and layers of grief and loss here. And she actually mentioned that. So again, I am not an adoptive parent, but I feel for you, man, if that's something you've been grappling with, or you have grappled with, or maybe you haven't even grappled with it yet, and that's something that you need to work on moving forward. She also mentions about how she was kicking herself for missing things. But again, hindsight is 2020. I hear that a lot from the alumni from my course saying, oh, I wish I knew this. I knew this then, you know, what I know now. And there's nothing you could do about it. You can only focus and worry about what you can worry about. And that's moving forward. They're talking about the primary symptoms of sleep and sensory issues being presented very early on, like as soon as, you know, her kid got home with dealing with that. And I thought it was so interesting and a great point that Annette made when she said our kids tell us. They tell us what's going on. And especially when her little guy was struggling to read, and the teacher was saying, telling him to visualize it. And he said, Mom, the teacher's telling me to visualize it and I can't. Because that's a pretty abstract thing that your brain needs to do. An abstract procedure that your brain needs to do. We need to listen to our guys. What are they telling us? If not, like, literally telling us with their words if it's too much or they can't handle it, or if they're telling us with their symptoms, like with their behaviors when they get overwhelmed. Grief and loss has been woven throughout this episode, I feel. And when she said she was first introduced to FASD, she saw the pamphlet, but she saw the face and she straight up said, listen, I was in denial. She was in denial about it. And that's, you know, a stage of grief and loss. So, and that's totally okay. Another great phrase that I heard from her about when she was explaining in terms of the type of support they need, and she said, she called, like, David needs to be a moth to the flame. And isn't that so nice? I just picture that, right? That you are the flame, you're the caregiver, and they're the moth, right? And they need you to shine super bright so they could hover around you, so they could feel safe, do good. And I don't mean like hover all day, every day. You know what I mean by that. But that was a good visual that she did. Again, grief and loss. Talked about giving up a career to watch the kids. She said, I made a lot of money. I was doing good. I had to give up equity in a firm. Gee, I don't even know if I know what that means, but I did watch a lot of Suits, or, you know, Tara watched a lot of Suits. So I imagine that's literally giving up assets in the firm, and she was probably profit sharing, and she had to give that up. That's what I'm, you know, or any equity the business accumulated while getting bigger and bigger and bigger and being worth more. I think that's what's going on. I should give myself more credit. You know, TV teaches me. But at the same time, she had to give that up. And she said she took her a long time, and sometimes she still grapples with that. She still grapples with, you know, wanting to be in there. Because you could tell, man, she's corporate in the best, in the most kind ways. We need those people. But she was able to turn that focus, and now obviously creating such a good organization. She talked about talking to her boys about FASD, and again, grief and loss. At first, there was that denial. But I like what she did say. She said, I didn't hide it from them. She wanted to give them a reason why they struggled. And I get that question, when should I tell my loved one on the spectrum that there's some, you know, they are on the spectrum? For some, like, this is my generic answer. For some, never. Like, if they're blissfully ignorant and they're just happy and they're doing their own thing and it would just complicate matters, then I don't. But if they are using these self-depreciating words and terms, and I hate myself, why am I like this? If they're thinking this is their fault and they're expressing that in their language and their actions, then absolutely. But everybody's different, so it all depends on you. When do you think it's important? But she talked about that it took a while. I've interviewed other individuals on the spectrum too. It takes a while to accept it and to come to terms with what's going on. And she said, now my sons kind of have come to terms. So I really like what she said. She wanted to give them a reason why they struggled. There's such a spectrum with FASD. She talked about the difference between both of her boys. One, David, I met, I hung out with him, nice kid. Well, now he's not a kid, grown ass adult now. But the other one, so like David, so introverted, hangs with himself. And then we have the other young man who is extroverted, who is expressive language is so strong that he's renting Ferraris in Beverly Hills, but being vulnerable by not understanding what's going on, right? Having all of the words, but limited in the understanding and with the creditors. And this is what happens to our guys. They're vulnerable, become unprotected, and they will be exploited. And I know that's a big concern for a lot of folks, and it's something that you need to be on the lookout for. It was really nice, that reaction to David getting his driver's license. That was genuine. Not that I was surprised, but just like a fist pump. That's amazing. I don't know if I would have seen that, but who am I to judge? That's what I've learned, man. Do not count individuals on the spectrum out. Do not count them out. And now the kid has his driver's license in Los Angeles. You ever drive there? It's nuts. And he could do it. And I think that's amazing. Here's a pitfall to avoid, the credit card situation. Make sure you guys are on top of that. Clearly, she said they had a big issue with that. So credit card. I guess the overall thing is money. She said her kids still struggle with money even today. And that's true, because we know individuals on the spectrum have a hard time with money because that's an abstract concept. Money is numbers, or money is like a value. Value, I think, is the abstract concept. It could be, it's like pieces of paper with numbers on it. One of the best pieces of advice that I ever got was from one of my facilitators. And she said, if you can help an individual on the spectrum manage their time and money, 75% of their problems will go away. Just think about that. That's how much those aspects of their lives leave them to be so vulnerable. We expect that adults need to budget and be able to do their own. But if one of your primary characteristics is really not understanding numbers and math, last episode, check it out with Sheila Burns. Even last episode, she said, doesn't matter how many times you tell me, I'm not going to get it. I don't get math. It's not my strong suit. And if you hear Sheila Burns talk and you know what she's all about, she's a smart lady, man. She's like, why are we even doing this? So why can't we come up with different interventions to help to make sure they're successful with their money? And then she grew a massive organization. And even with, she's gone on to co-found the FASD Network of Southern California. You can tell it early in the interview, I butchered it. I just forgot. There are so many organization names flipping through my skull at any given one time. That was a slip by me, though. I should have known it. But she came in, she swooped in, she helped me out. So it is the FASD Network of Southern California. And so she did this in 2010, and she served as treasurer and secretary, and they're bringing speakers and trainers in, and now she's having to pivot, just like a lot of organizations pivot to the online world. But she's done it. So she's taken these hardships and this grief and loss and all this turbulence to help her boys navigate, and she's given up her career. But does everything happen for a reason? Like if Annette doesn't adopt, her boys, and doesn't leave work, does she not start, be one of the co-founders for the FASD Network of Southern California? so many people don't get help and so many people don't get to join their community. I just, you know, I wonder the way the universe works, that she is the exact person that we needed to create this network. It's just getting there wasn't the way she thought it was going to be. And she's still dealing. She's still doing great. And I think this is just an incredible story of transitioning and lessons learned. And, you know, if you're in that situation where your kids want to go or you're scared about it, this is a pretty darn good roadmap of how to do it. So if you are in Southern California, go to the network, go to www.fasdsocalnetwork.org. You know, drop Annette a line. Everything's going to be in our show notes, fasdsuccess.com/podcast. Where all the blog posts go of all the previous episodes with all the resources on there. So go check it out. Okay, I've gone on for way too long, but, you know, it's important to understand about transitioning into adulthood. And this is just one story of doing that. It, you know, her story isn't your story. So just because she's had some turbulent times doesn't mean your kids are going to have the same issues. Her boys got diagnosed late. If you got an earlier diagnosis, you know what to prepare for. You know what you need to do and what to work on until they become adults to make sure that transitioning is as successful as possible, because I know it could happen because I've seen it, because I've talked to it. And if you need to listen to other adults from previous podcasts, go and do it, because there's four or five who are successfully doing that as we speak, and we get into how they do it. But you know what? It's about helping them do that and not expecting them that when they become 18 that all of a sudden they'll have all these brain skills in order to manage living on their own without help, you know, without good solid supports. And we have to make sure that we are spending our whole lives getting and putting together these teams and supports so that when they reach adulthood, they could transition and everybody's awesome. You know who's awesome? You're awesome, man. If you listen to this far, you're a beauty. And I really appreciate the reviews people have been leaving and the comments. And I'm glad you're liking this. I love doing this. I'm not going to be going anywhere. And I will be right back here, man. Like, you have a tough job. So if you're in the trenches every day, I'm in the trenches. I'm in the trenches creating content and trying to get the people that you need to hear to make your life better, to try and teach you about FASD so you could teach others, because that's what this is all about. So we're just trying to help that so we can create success. That's why the show is called FASD Success. And if you've listened this far, that makes you a success. I love you. And I will absolutely see you back here next week. So keep up the amazing work, because you're an amazing man. Bye.